Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Leo is on vacation this week, but we talked to Bradley Chambers. He manages devices in a school, and we're going to talk about BYOD, why it might not be the best choice for you, and how he picks the best iPad apps. All that and so much more coming up on iOS Today. This episode of iOS Today is brought to you by Qualcomm Snapdragon. According to Ookla, Android smartphones with Snapdragon 845 from Qualcomm had faster data speeds on AT&T and T-Mobile than non-Android phones with Intel modems, based on over a million real-world tests done in Q2 2018. See all the data for yourself at qualcomm.com/twit. And by ExpressVPN. Protect your online activity today for 3 months free with a 1-year package. Go to expressvpn.com/iOS today. Welcome to iOS Today. This is a show where we talk about iPhones and iPads and Apple Watches, Apple TVs, all the things. It's the day before the big Apple announcement. So if you're watching this the day after the Apple announcement and you think, why aren't they talking about the Apple announcement? That's because we don't know. I mean, we kind of know, but we don't know for sure. So I thought with Leo on vacation, I would invite one of my favorite writers about Apple, and that is Bradley Chambers. He has been writing about Apple for, I found him on 9 to 5 Mac. He writes a weekly column called Making the Grade because he manages devices at a school, but he's actually been managing devices, Apple devices, for since 2009. Welcome, Bradley.
Glad to be here. yeah, somebody was asking me about that the other day, like, you know, what was it like in 09? And, you know, it feels like a lifetime ago because that, I mean, that we were like the iPhone 3GS and there was no iPad. And the management tools were terrible in a lot of ways. And just to, and they were, the person was asking me, like, what did you go to school for to get into this? And I said, well, I didn't. I have a business degree. But the problem is everything I do, none of it existed then. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and it's weird to me to think about because, like, I'm 34 and my career is in some ways like completely turned over. And I don't know how that's going to keep going. Like, I have to keep learning.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe you'll move to Android or Windows next.
I don't know. Well, it's funny. So I was not a Mac user until like 05. Oh. And I was, yeah, it was really weird. So there, and so my job is like I manage an all Apple school and or manage the IT for it. And then I kind of do a lot of freelance writing and things like that. And so really everything about my ability to earn an income, it relates to Apple. Well, I was working at a telephone company in Northwest Georgia, and I was like a PC user, and a guy there like had a PowerBook G4, and that's just the greatest computer ever, I think. Like, that was my favorite Mac of all time. Now, obviously, like, not compared today, it's terrible, but like at the time, I just loved it. It was just such a great computer, and he had it, and I loved it, and I ended up buying one, and like, oh, I'm totally a Mac user from then on, and then obviously iPhone and iPad, and yeah, it's just funny how life runs that way. I kind of owe that guy, his name was Doug McNish. I kind of owe that guy like kind of everything with my career at this point.
Well, thank you, Doug.
Yeah, thank you, Doug. You know what app really I loved and was so impressed with? You're going to think this is funny, is the Stickies app. It's such a good app because it's like it automatically, it's always saved. And like you just you shut it down, you open it back up, all your stickies come back. It is just one of those apps that hasn't changed much since then, mm-hmm. but it's really reliable.
Yeah, I do remember that. And it's, you know, I guess it's now it's Notes.
No, Stickies is still there.
Yeah, right. But I mean, Notes is what I think but Stickies not on iOS.
No, it's not. So like I use it just as like a scratch pad for mm-hmm. things. And like I'll still use it. And it's a great app. But that was the app that really kind of got me turned on to the Mac originally. I mean, this was like back in Panther days. I mean, my first Mac OS was Panther, and that was back when, like, I remember when the dashboard came out. Those were good days.
Yeah. I mean, I think of Notes as that because now, because I can put notes on my computer and then on my iPad, and it's everywhere. And yeah, I love it.
I always think about too, like when people say, "Oh, Apple software quality has gone down since then." It's like, Well, maybe. But like, think about what we're asking these devices to do. We want to like put something on one device and have it appear magically on like all of our other devices. And so maybe that's just harder to do in reality. And so maybe if like all Apple had to do was Mac OS, maybe things would be as smooth as we, you know, kind of remember from back then. Like, we ask our devices to do a lot today.
We sure do. One of the things we ask them to do is entertain our children or educate our children or help educate our children. So I thought we would start with talking about some of your favorite apps for kids. And you sent me a list. But before we get to that, I want you to, you wrote a piece about how to pick the best iPad app. So none of the apps that you talk about today might not exactly be what someone's looking for their kids, but give us some advice on how to pick the best iPad apps, because there's a lot of garbage out there. So how do you sift through it and find the good stuff?
Well, yeah, there is a really a lot of garbage on the App Store, and it's not things that are bad, but so a couple things, and this article was written from the perspective, like as an IT person or as a technology integrator, is how do you decide, like how do you wade through that? Because, you know, I'll go to conferences and they'll say, oh, the 30 best apps for your classroom. And I want to think, like, you don't need 30, you need 5 in reality. You know, like, you can't possibly effectively use all 30. So one of the things, like, I look for is update frequency. And so you can see that in the App Store. Like, you can say, you know, show me the last updates. And then on Apple's Volume Purchase Program store, it will actually show the most recent update. And this became really key as iOS dropped support for 32-bit apps. It's like we had apps that we had used for years that, like, when we updated to iOS 11 at our school, that, like, just didn't work anymore. And so that is a concern. You know, obviously, like, your teachers are frustrated because, like, hey, this app I've used for years doesn't work. But, like, the developer hasn't updated it. And, you email them. They don't respond. Probably they're not even in business anymore. And then I look back and, like, we paid $1 for it, you know, 4 years ago. Like, you know, we got our money's worth out of it. But it is frustrating for teachers when things just do stop working. So that's, like, if, you know, I'm looking for something today, it's like, how, you know, if this wasn't updated within the last year, I kind of don't consider it. That's just a red flag to me that it's not being maintained. The next thing is... I know the trend is free within app purchase for consumer apps, but the problem with for apps for schools is there's no way for school people to kind of do in-app purchase unlock. So I think I've maybe talked about this before. Like, when I go to buy an app, I don't go to the App Store to iTunes. I go to a website called the Apple Volume Purchase Program, and I have a credit card on file, and I can buy, you know, 20 copies of an app. And most developers opt in to where if I buy 20 or more, I get it for half off. So it's cheaper to buy 20 than it is to buy 19. Now, not all developers do that, but again, most do. So I buy an app through there, and I choose what's called Manage Distribution. And then that wirelessly sends, or not wirelessly, like through the internet, sends the licensing to my mobile device management system, or we call it an MDM. And I use one called Jamf Pro. So I log into Jamf Pro, and that app license appears there, and I could just wirelessly push it to all these devices, like without ever touching them. So I could theoretically have, you know, devices all over the city if I needed to, and could just remove apps and add apps. Now, the cool thing is, if I buy 20 copies and we only need it on these set of iPads for, say, this week, at the end of the week, I can pull those apps back off and then push them to another set of apps. So they're not tied to a specific Apple ID. They're kind of just tied to a device for a period of time. Did I explain that well?
I think so. So when you the way it works at your school, like a teacher will say, I want to use this app, or do you usually say, you know, I recommend this app, or how does that work?
It's both. Like, there may be so, for example, we're rolling out a new handwriting curriculum for our lower kids. Well, there's an app that goes along with that. So, like, they bring, you know, there's a reason we're deploying it. Or it may be they're, you know, doing something new in math, and they were Googling around and found an app that would work, or another teacher recommended it, or I find one that they may come to me and ask for advice, and I'll kind of go for a hunt on one. But again, it's like when we get something, like, I don't have to go around to each iPad. I can just wirelessly over the air push it to everything. So I say all that to say, I cannot do in-app purchases on these apps. So if an app is free and it has like, three sections of it's free and you have to pay $5 to unlock the rest of it, I just don't, there's not a way technically to do that. So if something is really reliant on in-app purchases, what I usually do is email the developer and explain the situation and say, hey, we'd like to buy 30 copies of this. I can't do in-app purchases. Can you make what's called a school edition? And a lot of developers will do this where it'll be one that's like, say, let's say if it's a free app normally and then they have an in-app purchase that's $10. They'll put a school edition on the store and just make it $10 and call it the, whatever app school edition. And that's the ones that schools can buy and then deploy. So again, I really try to avoid things with in-app purchases because not that I don't want to pay for them, but I can't.
Right. I want to get back to this handwriting app. Are they using the iPads to write on?
Yeah, it goes along with our curriculum. So like they're using their finger obviously to practice, and it kind of goes along with them learning how to write. I mean, these are 4 and 5 year olds. They're literally learning how to write. And so like there's just a component that goes along with it that can act for reinforcement to help them understand how to form the letters and things like that.
So it's interesting that they're learning to write with their fingers. I guess kids kind of always did learn like with finger painting and stuff. It seems strange that they're not learning with, that kind of thing that Apple announced, the Apple Pencil for Education. Are they too young for that?
Well, and it's not that I don't like that. It's really expensive. If you start looking at, I think it's not called the Crayon. The Crayon looks really neat, but it's, you start talking about $50 per iPad, it does become expensive. But yeah, I mean, this isn't the primary way they're learning this handwriting curriculum. It's just a way to augment it to help them to know how to form the A, to form the B. Again, they're doing the majority of the work with a pencil, but the iPad app is just kind of, work alongside it. Mm.
So let's get started with some of the apps that you recommended. One was Kinderlime. Is this the right Kinderlime? It's to run your childcare platform?
Yeah, so Kinderlime is a pretty neat app. So this is not something you'll put on a kid's iPad, but this is something like that I love at our school. So most schools have an after-school care program. And, it's like, how do you get the – make sure you know where your kids are? As a school person, like what kids are in what rooms, if a parent shows up, that maybe a grandparent's new, hey, I don't know where my kid's at. Well, we realized like we didn't either. Like we could find them, but we didn't know what room they were in. They were, they had a rotation. And so we found this service called Kinderlime. And what it is like we load our student database in there. And when kids go to aftercare, they're kind of quote unquote checked into a room. And then when their parents get there, they have an app on their phone that they can see what room they're in, and then they have a PIN code that is emailed out to them at the beginning of the year that they type into an iPad with the aftercare teacher, and then that says, hey, you're picking up these kids. And so it's like, A, it helps us to track where kids are internally. It's great for security. And then what's cool as well is it's automated the billing. And so we have it set up to bill, like we charge $4 an hour for aftercare. We have it set up to bill $1 every 15 minutes in the system. And it kind of has automated every bit of it. And it's a pretty affordable service. Like we're paying, I think, $2,000 a year for it. It's based on the number of students you have. But it's a really, really fantastic service. It's aimed at daycares and after school care systems. And of all the things we've done at our school, I've gotten the most compliments from parents on this because they love the security aspect of it. It even has stuff like a carpool feature where if like you say, you and your neighbor both go to our school and you take them, but your neighbor picks them up. You can give your neighbor access in the system to pick your kids up using your own PIN code. So they've really thought of a lot, and it really is a great solution.
I love hearing about apps like this because my husband's a teacher, so he's been in education and, I've been in technology, and I'll always suggest things to him, and he immediately gives me 10 reasons why it wouldn't work in the school environment. And so this is something that you've used, it's proven, mm-hmm. and it's not going to scare parents, or parents aren't going to say, be overwhelmed by it. Or find security holes in it or anything like that.
Yeah, we've really, our parents love it. They know where their kids are as soon as they pull up. And it's just kind of helped automate our school a little bit. And I think, you know, in Kindle Lime certainly is an app, but it's as much of a service as it is anything. And that's one of the trends I'm seeing a lot in schools today is we're using less apps, but we're using more services that have apps, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, I'm okay with that because going back to the update frequency, if I'm paying for something, you know, yearly or monthly through our school for our students, I can expect more frequent updates if I'm paying for something ongoing.
And so how did you find it?
I was at a conference and one of the people that was at the conference with us from our school, she found it and we went and talked to them. And it's like, we set it through a demo and we really liked it. And this is our second year on it. And they just released version 2 over the summer. So we transitioned to that. It has a lot of neat features, things we were asking for. And it's just been great. I mean, again, it takes a little bit of work to get set up. You've got to import all your students in there. You've got to do some training with your parents to make sure, you know, they have their PIN codes. But the cool thing is, like this year, everybody from last year already had their PIN code. So we only had to get the new parents on the system this year. Mm-hmm. And so it was a lot easier.
So the next one is Spelling City. I think I have this one on my iPad too. So this is also a service, it looks like, because you.
It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. It's. So obviously, like, you know, in the lower grades, they have spelling words, they have spelling tests. And, you know, sometimes like just writing them over and over again can get a little boring. Mm-hmm. And so Spelling City is a service that we pay for that the teachers can load their apps into here. All the kids have logins. We send those logins to their parents. And so when they're at home, maybe let's say they've got a long commute. Well, they can grab their iPad or their parents' phone and do review games on their actual spelling words. The parents don't have to set it up. The lists are already in there from the teachers. And then, you know, teachers can see how often students are you know, using the games, or, you know, it's really, really great. It's, again, very affordable. I think we're paying a couple hundred bucks a year for it for a school license. I have to take a CSV file and upload it at the beginning of the school that has our entire school database. And then we go from there.
So how many years have you been using this?
It's probably our fourth year on it.
Mm. Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah, it's really to help, you know, with engagement on spelling and help them to have more exciting ways to practice than just writing them over and over and over again, which is important because that does help them, you know, to kind of memorize it by writing it. But this is a way, like I said, when they're in the car, long commute home, maybe they're waiting on their brother or sister to finish, you know, ball practice, they can get some spelling work in.
So those people who think that kids aren't learning spelling or handwriting anymore, they are in Tennessee.
That's right.
A state with no income tax.
That's great.
Okay, so now, and typing. They're also learning typing. Tap Typing. Now, is that an app that you learn typing on the iPad or on the iPad keyboard or on a regular keyboard or both?
Can be either. I've done it on both. So Tap Typing is a fantastic app. And that's a good example of one that has a school version as well. So it's a paid app or a free app within that purchase. So we have the paid app. And it's helped kids to learn how to type on touchscreens, but it also will work with a soft, you know, or a hardware keyboard. So we have some of the Belkin keyboards that are Lightning adapters. And it works great. Like, kids can kind of level up. They can build a profile on the iPads. And, it's kind of a modern rethinking of what a typing app should look like. Because, again, I know typing on a keyboard is important. But I'm faster on a keyboard than I'm a touchscreen. But I'm probably like the last generation of people that probably will say that. I think there's probably a generation coming up that are going to prefer typing on the screen than maybe a physical keyboard, or maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong. But this is helping them not only type faster on a physical keyboard, but also on the software keyboard as well.
I'm taking the test right now. It's about putting. I'm still taking it. I'm not as good as I thought I was. I actually remember taking a typing test when I was working at a temp agency on a, you know, I guess it was a computer. It wasn't a typewriter, but I used to type fast, but apparently not while I'm podcasting. So go ahead.
You know, I wonder if in the future, if we'll have like tests with like using the voice assistants, like, you know, hey, voice assistant, do this. And like we judge based on how fast we can talk to those people. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah. Just kidding.
How fast or how clear?
True.
Like, how clearly
that's a good point. That's a good point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you don't want Siri to to think that you're saying things that you're not.
It's always a weird thing is like with the HomePod, my wife and I were talking, I guess it was last night, and somehow like the S lady, she got activated. And I was like, I didn't say her name. How did she figure that out? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, we were in the middle, my husband and I, with my daughter. It was like a very serious conversation. All of a sudden, Alexa was like, I don't understand what you're saying. It was like,
get out of the room.
Yeah, exactly. First of all, why were you listening to us? And second of all, but it did diffuse the moment, which was, it was kind of nice. So tap typing, that is, how much does that cost?
It's free with in-app purchases. And I think there's a school version. I think it's either $5 or $10. It's not much. Again, you'll pay per license. But, you know, it's funny when teachers come to me and say, hey, I really want to use this app, but it's $2. Is that okay? I always explain to them how much we used to pay for desktop software. And we were, you know, we were paying $40 or $50 a license, and now we're paying, you know, $2. It's nothing.
That is funny. That's $2.
Well, it's funny. Like they'll say, "Oh, I like both of these. This one's free." I'll say, "Well, which one do you like that's paid?" Like, "Oh, I like this one. Let's do the paid one." Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the things I always try to tell people. It's like, look, a free app's going to have ads in it. I can't control what those ads are, and sometimes, like, even if they're, you know, supposed to be decent ads, bad stuff gets through, and I don't want to deal with that. Mm-hmm. So let's buy the paid one. It's worth spending $25 on it to not have to deal with the ads inside the apps.
And so how do you manage the iPads at the school? Like, no kids can download apps, right?
No. It's the App Store is literally not even on the devices. It's all through Jamf, like I said before, mm-hmm. and it's all over the air. That's one of the things where I don't know that Apple has been given enough credit over the years is how quickly they expanded out their mobile device management APIs. Mm-hmm. I mean, from where we went in 2010, we were using an app called iPhone Configuration Utility to deploy iPads through iTunes. I mean, I used to have to, like, when I was updating iPads, I'd have to plug them up like three at a time to iTunes. I mean, you think iTunes is slow. Try updating multiple iPads at a time. Well, then we got an app called Apple Configurator, and I think 2012 is when we got that app. And then it was like a stripped out version of the management piece for iPads and iPhones in a separate app. But again, it you know, that works when you have, say, 20 or 30. But this doesn't scale when you've got hundreds or thousands of iPads. And now you have through what's called Apple School Manager, they have Apple Business Manager as well. I can buy iPads from Apple, and they come directly already enrolled through what's called the device enrollment program. It's an Apple technology, but the serial numbers are already in there that I bought. And then I easily import those into my management system, which is, again, Jamf. And there's a lot of companies that do this, AirWatch, Maz 360, and they're all using the APIs from Apple. And everybody just kind of puts their own spin on it. I really like Jamf because they're an Apple-only MDM. And so they kind of really always, you know, have zero-day support for the new iOS. They have kind of the best interface, I think, for the iOS and Mac management. And so, you know, I can, once I get them loaded, in, you know, into Jamf, you know, get them set up. They get all their configuration profiles. The apps just appear. And I'll give you a good example. As I was moving some iPads from one grade to to another this year, I literally just moved them into the system. I think it was an iPad going from second grade down to first. This iPad had a totally different set of apps. I clicked two buttons. All the second grade apps were removed, and all the first grade apps immediately appeared. They just downloaded. The apps update automatically. I can actually update iOS automatically. So when iOS 12 comes out, I could theoretically update that right away over the air and without any interaction from the user. It'll just download, install, and reboot. Now, what I'll be doing there is there's actually a feature that came out in iOS 11.3 that you can delay software updates for 90 days, which I absolutely will be doing. And I'll explain why in just a minute. But yeah, so I'll enable that. And even if a user tried to update their iPad through the software update, it would not allow them. It wouldn't even show them that there was an update available. So my hope is that, number one, we'll avoid any kind of show-stopping bugs on day one. And I don't think it would be iOS 12 bugs. I think it would be bugs that related to our apps that we have. So, you know, I've been testing iOS 12, but I don't know that all of our app developers are. So I want to, you know, obviously with that, I want to avoid that. And because once you update, it's pretty hard to go back. Mm-hmm. And then I also don't want to have, you know, put iOS 12. And then, you know, 2 weeks from now, iOS 12.0.1 comes out. And then 2 weeks later, 12.0.2 comes out. I really would just like to wait and go straight to 12.0.2 or whatever, the, you know, kind of the first big bug release fix is.
So you update everything on your end.
Mm-hmm. Yep. People don't even know. I don't have to send out emails saying, hey, please update your iPads. It's through the manager system. I hit a button that says, you know, update these devices, and it happens. It's amazing. That's why the iPad, I think, has done so well in the enterprise and in kiosk mode and in schools, because IT departments, it's easy to manage. And again, 5 years ago, we didn't have this ability, but Apple has continually added things. And that's like every year when WWDC rolls around, that's what I'm excited about most, is seeing what new management techniques Apple's given us.
Mm-hmm. And so how are the apps doing so far on your beta, the iPads that you're running betas? Have you been testing your apps on iOS 12?
Yeah, I mean, I've tested some of them. Most of them, they seem to be working fine. I always just worry, is there something in the GM, like the Gold Master version, that like is going to change? And again, there's a big difference, like when you've got an app that you use personally that maybe doesn't work on day one. If I somehow get iOS 12 on day one on all of our iPads, and an app a teacher was counting on doesn't work, like that's a problem. And so they would rather not have the new iOS 12 features than have one of their core apps not work. So we always wait. Again, now I cannot force it to wait. But, so my hope is, what I'll probably do is over Christmas break, aggressively try to do it and just kind of wait and see what happens. Give all of our apps time to get updates out and go from there. I mean, there's nothing that our school's going to do in iOS 12 that will impact us a whole lot. So I don't see a reason to kind of aggressively move to it. I'm just, in some ways, asking for problems.
Right. iOS 11 was when they introduced the coding. The coding game that
Swift Playgrounds.
Yeah, Swift. That was iOS 11, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that is something that I don't think that people consider when they talk about like Chromebooks versus iPads. Mm-hmm. That Swift Playgrounds is really, really good. The difficulty of it ramps up quickly. But it's a really, really great set of coding curriculum. And I've taught a class using it. I'll do another one in January. And this year I'm using some of the Sphero robots. I know we're going to be, you know, kind of doing things with that. And Swift Playgrounds can talk directly to them. And so when you think about trying to save, you know, if your iPad's $299, but the Chromebook is, say, $179, what's this coding curriculum worth to you? To me, it's worth $100. It's really, really great. And it's free. And I mean, again, I'm pretty impressed with it. I think it makes it easy to learn some basic coding. And it's not like playing games. It's writing actual code. We teach it with our fourth and fifth graders here. And I mean, again, they're writing actual Swift code. Are they building an app? No. But you know, it's just like we have a cooking class that we do as well. We have a kind of a system called the four C's. And it's coding, cooking, chess and construction. And so they rotate every 9 weeks between one of those. So like when they do the construction, they're learning how to build a birdhouse. We don't expect kids to come out of the construction class learning how to build a house, just like we don't expect them coming out of the coding class to know how to build apps. There's a lot more as it goes into building an app than just the Swift code. There's, you know, web APIs, there's front-end design, there's, you know, user experience. I have two hopes with the coding curriculum. One is I can expose them to it, and if they really like it, they can go on as they get older and kind of delve into it. And the second thing is helping kids learn how to troubleshoot. And I think that's one of the biggest problems with even adults today. So good example. If like my fridge is broken, I just want it to work. I just want it to be fixed, right? I don't want to tinker with it. I just like want to call a repairman. And I had my fridge break recently, and my dad and I ended up fixing it, and we found what was wrong on YouTube, and we found the part to buy locally, and he was explaining to me, he said, Bradley, he said, that's the difference between what you have access to today and what I had access to when I was your age. It's like, we didn't have YouTube. We had to just like search the manuals. And so I've had to kind of consciously tell myself, like, take time to learn things like that. Like, because if that problem ever happened again, I would know how to fix it. And like when my son's fridge breaks one day, I'll know how to fix that part. But like kids today, I don't think know the difference between I don't know and I don't understand. Mm-hmm. Because those are very different things. And this, with the Swift curriculum, it kind of gets difficult quick, and you've got to really think about it. And so they'll say, you know, Mr. Chambers, I don't understand this. And I'll say, look, I gave this to y'all 5 minutes ago. There's no way you've even thought about it enough to know you don't understand it. Give it 20 minutes and then come ask me. And most of the time, they end up figuring it out. But this is a generation that's been raised on Google and YouTube their whole lives. And so they're used to being able to find problems rather or find solutions to problems rather than being able to just, work on themselves.
Yeah, when you came and talked on KnowHow, we talked a little bit about devices, like smart devices in the classroom, which is really, I mean, it's interesting because it's a very young generation that has grown up with that, which is just, I'm going to ask a question and get an answer versus here's the tool and I'm going to go look for it. So I hope that the smart devices aren't training kids against that, go in that instinct of like, well, I have the information at my fingertips. I just need to find it.
Yeah, and obviously we love the modern technology to be able to, you know, find things quickly and find answers quickly. But I think the downside of that is it's taught us that like troubleshooting is a waste of time. And I think there's value in figuring out how things work.
Yeah, nothing has taught me more than this working with smart home stuff. It is, yeah, just it. You have to do it 10 times sometimes for it to work. And I'm with you. Finding the answer, finding how to do something on YouTube and then doing it yourself is very satisfying.
It is. I mean, when we fixed my fridge that day, like it was awesome. Like we found it is a $30 part and it saved me probably a $300 repair bill. And then like we fixed it like it took 3 hours, but I didn't have to like hire anybody. It was awesome. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but I'll say on smart home stuff, like that industry has really come a long way, I would say. And it's finally to a place where I could recommend it to normal people. Like I think things like HomeKit and Google Assistant and can I say the A word?
Sure, what trigger, sure.
Just don't tell her to buy anything, then we'll be fine. Good point. Like I think it's finally to a place where I could recommend that technology to regular people. My wife actually made the comment, like we've got the iDevices switches around our house hooked into HomeKit. And she told me a few weeks ago, she said, you know, these actually work a lot better than I thought they would. Like we can trigger them with our HomePod. We can use the apps on our iPhones and iPads to turn lights on. And it really works. Like I love the place that home automation is at now.
I do too, but it's also really frustrating. But maybe the frustration is good.
Well, I think we're probably at a place in like 20 years it'll be where you don't even think about it. Because occasionally I'll have to reboot a device and things like that. And I imagine it needs to get to like refrigerator level stability where like you literally don't even think about it. Like you just – your home comes with it or whatever. But from where it was 10 years ago, like you had to hire a whole house integrator to build this stuff for you. Now it's like, oh, I get all the stuff off Amazon.
Yeah. So we have a couple more apps. Leaf Snap was one that you recommended. I wonder if this is the right one because it looks like it's more of an iPhone app. It doesn't take up the – was this the correct one?
Yeah, it's one of those that hasn't been updated in a while, but it's still really good. What you can do with it is you can like take pictures of leaves and it will try to identify them for you. And so we've done some projects with that where students have to go like find leaves in their yard and then find information about them, find the name of them, and then go from there. It's pretty good.
You could also, this is leaf matching game I am not very good at. But this is good to me to know that I can't really recognize. Oh, I did it. So Leaf Snap, it works great on the iPhone. And that one, is that one free?
I believe so. I believe that one is free because I think it's made by a nonprofit.
Yeah, it looks like that's free by Columbia University and University of Maryland. And
probably what happened is the students who built this graduated and that was like a project of theirs. And so it's probably never get updated again. Yeah.
And then there were three there that you recommended that I love that I was playing around with that I Endless Numbers, Endless Reader, and Endless Spanish. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so these apps, to me, are perfect. Like, the developer of these, they just know how kids are. Like, clearly, this developer group has kids at home. I like the Endless Reader, for example. Like, they'll put a word up there, and they have the letters scrambled, like, at the bottom. And you have to drag the letters to match. And while you're dragging them, it's like kind of just repeating how the letters sound. So if it's like A, it's ah, the entire time you're dragging it. It's really annoying as an adult. But like my son that's five, he's been playing this game for years. And like he really, it's helped him quite a bit. And so they have one with numbers, they have one with letters, and they have one with Spanish words as well. And it's really, really good. This developer just totally gets it.
I really love this. I mean, it is, it makes me sad that it wasn't around when my kids were little. Oh, there we go. But it's so, I mean, so these, all the three of these are great. I tried them all. And it is really, because I think that it's hard to find apps like this. There's so, mm-hmm. like I said before, there's so much garbage out there. There's so many ads. There's so many, you know, things that are going. Yeah, they're just trying to sneak in something that, you know, to sell your kids something, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, it is funny. He's talking about something, sell your kids. Like, so we don't have cable at home, and my kids have never had cable. And so then they go somewhere that has like, you know, television, like, you know, cable. They'll turn on the Disney Channel or something, and they see commercials. And I realize, oh, I'm so glad we don't have cable, because the number of things that they want after watching like a 30-minute show, they want all the commercials. They want all of the toys. And I'm glad we don't have to deal with that.
Yeah, I'm same. We never had it. But then once YouTube became a reality in our lives, that's when the ads came in. But luckily, I think by the time they were really allowed to watch YouTube by themselves, they were more critical thinkers and could understand when someone was trying to sell something, and you know, not so it wasn't so early on, I think.
My kids do. They are masters at knowing how to, like, even my, like, 2-year-old, she knows how to skip a YouTube ad really quick. And it's like, that's pretty impressive. I will say the business I never thought that would take off that has on YouTube is my kids love to watch other kids unbox toys. They love that stuff. And it's like, I'm in the wrong business. Like, I think there was this lady, her name was like the Disney Collector. I think Disney made her change her name. But she was one of the most popular YouTube channels like years ago. All she did was unbox Disney toys. And like, that's where she had like millions of subscribers. And someone did like an analysis based on like her ad revenue. They think she was making like $300,000 a year off YouTube opening toys. Like, I'm in the wrong business.
Yeah, that one is, and you don't grow out of that, because my 13-year-olds watch Unbox Therapy all the time. And, you know, it's just, and they didn't grow up with those toy unboxings. It's just something I like to watch unboxings also.
We watch them with like iPhones. So I guess it just like, but it is like, I could have been like a millionaire if like only like 5 years ago I was like knew that would be a thing. Like, I remember when YouTube started, like it was like not owned by Google.
Yeah.
And like, if I could just had the forethought to like, this is going to be a thing, like I would just, I don't know, be on an island somewhere making YouTube videos all day. Great.
So, we had someone call in last week. They wanted to figure out how to remove things like unboxing videos from YouTube, just so not like they already had the parental stuff on there, but just like certain things like that. Do you have any idea?
I don't. I mean, there's the YouTube Kids app. Mm-hmm. And that's about the best I know. I mean, that's a pretty good app, but I don't know. I don't know. That's tough.
Yeah, I think they still have toy unboxings. I haven't used it lately, but I would guess that they do. Well, we're going to talk more about managing devices. We're going to talk about maybe your what's going to happen with the possible USB-C iPad news, what that will do, and just lots more, and another one of your favorite apps, and you have a hat. But first, I want to take a minute to thank our sponsor of this show, Qualcomm. Now, Qualcomm Snapdragon is bringing you this show, which is interesting because it's an iOS show, but I know a lot of Android phone users use iPads, or maybe they don't even use iPads, but they like to watch this show. So I know you want faster data speeds on your phone. Of course you do. Everyone wants faster data speeds on their phone because waiting is annoying, whether it's in line, in traffic, or when you have one bar of signal and it's taking forever to finish downloading your music playlist. It's agonizing. So how can you get faster data speeds even without switching carriers? Turns out all you need is the right phone. Ookla analyzed over 1 million real-world results from the speed test app taken by users like you on AT&T and T-Mobile in Q2 and found that Android phones with Snapdragon 845 from Qualcomm Technologies had up to 192% faster data speeds than non-Android phones with Intel modems. Seriously, that's 192%. And that proof is backed by speed tests, whom we trust. And the Snapdragon 845 is engineered with powerful features that will allow you to do even more with your phone. Immersive XR experiences. The third generation Qualcomm Hexagon 685 DSP supports sophisticated on-device AI processing, delivering richer camera, voice, XR, and gaming experiences. They also have advanced vault-like security. It's designed with a new Qualcomm secure processing unit that's engineered to help protect personal data. Biometrics used for authentication can be stored in isolation, keeping precious data out of prying eyes. It's energy efficient and engineered for all-day battery life, capable of up to 50% charge in only 15 minutes. So you can check it out all for yourself. All you have to do is go to qualcomm.com/twit, then upgrade your data speeds with a phone powered by Snapdragon 845. That's qualcomm.com/twit. And we thank Qualcomm for their support of iOS Today. So like I said before, you write a regular column for 9to5 Mac called Making the Grade. And one of your most recent pieces was why BYOD, bring your own device, should be avoided. And you have three reasons why. I love this because my daughter and my husband teaches at a private school. My daughter goes there and they've gone back and forth. They had Mac laptops for a long time. Then they decided they were all going to have Windows laptops and everybody hated it. And now they are in the BYOD and they like it because the kids that can afford nice devices have them, and then they subsidize the kids who can't. So it's sort of a everybody kind of gets what they want, which is a Mac. But let me know why are they doing it wrong?
Well, so the first part is the one of the subheadings I have is a standard that there's no standard. Mm-hmm. So let's say, for example, let's not think about technology. Let's think about books. What if we had to bring your own books? You bring your own textbooks. And so it says you just have to bring any science book. Well, how is a teacher supposed to know what science book you have? What lessons are in what order? Now, again, if you say, look, we're going to do BYOD, but we're going to say it has to be this Mac with these specs, I disagree still, but I can get on board with that. But I think what you said was very important is like the students who can't afford the more expensive devices get them. Now, again, I know a situation where you're subsidizing, there's a difference there. But what if you're in a school where they don't subsidize? So you've got some kids like with an iPad Pro, you got some with like maybe an iPad 2 running iOS 9. It's like the old family iPad that the dad just gives them. Oh, this will be fine. And so you got this like gamut of devices that the teachers don't know what they all can do. And so what happens is the teachers have to start kind of planning to the lowest common denominator. You know, whatever the worst device they have, that's what they have to do. So again, now up until recently, how you managed BYOD devices was differently than how you managed kind of institutional owned devices. So Apple has this ability to do what's called supervising iPads. And so when you supervise an iPad, you can control more aspects of it. It's kind of like you own it. And that goes along with that device enrollment program, because those serial numbers come hard coded to my account with Apple, like my school's account. And for example, if my iPad, if I have an iPad get stolen and someone goes to wipe it and they even put it into the disk firmware utility mode, as soon as it reinstalls iOS, it immediately downloads all my stuff again. There's no way to wipe it with it until I do what's called disowning it in the system. And so for a long time, you couldn't supervise BYOD devices. Now you can. You can kind of silo them into your system, but it's a manual process. And the iPads are wiped when that happens, and they have the ability to opt out after 30 days. So I think it's just a little bit more of a messy deployment. I think it's a lot smoother for IT if they buy the iPads, even if you charge the parents, even if you say, hey, we're going to bill you $300 for this iPad. If you buy it and you kind of self-manage it, I think it's just easier to handle. Now let me ask you a question. So you said your daughter's schools, they all have Macs, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, so they can have, as long as they have a Windows 10, it has to be Mac OS 10 or Windows 10, but okay. Very few have the Windows.
So my first question is, if they have mixed devices, are they not basically using web-based tools?
Yeah, they're just using web-based tools mostly.
See, you might as well have Chromebooks at that point. Mm-hmm. Because going back to the teachers don't know, can't you kind of use a specific app for the Mac or for the PC? Because not everybody will have one. And my second question with that is, what happens if your daughter breaks her laptop?
She gets in trouble.
We
have to fix it.
For that? Okay, what if... your husband, you're out of town for work and your husband can't get to the Apple store for 3 days. What does she use?
Right.
And so in an institutional model, if, we always have like extra devices. So if someone brings me a damaged laptop, I just hand them another laptop and I get it fixed. Or if it's like an iPad, probably just don't get it fixed because it's too expensive to get fixed. But we always have devices that are floating around that we can swap in. Now in the BYOD program, parents are probably responsible for those repairs. Mm-hmm. So, again, can they get to the Genius Bar? We don't even have an Apple store, near our school. So do we have to go to Best Buy? Do we have to drive to Atlanta to the nearest Apple store? How quickly can these repairs be turned around? What if all your textbooks are on your iPad? You don't even have an iPad to use for a week. Like what, there's all these like what ifs that I guess I don't like with BYOD. I'm not saying it can't work, but if I have my preference, I would rather buy them and own them, even if you charge the parents a technology fee. I don't even necessarily want to charge the parents for them. I don't want the parents to own the devices in some ways because I want to be able to do what I want to do on it. If I was deploying iPads to K-12, even let's say 6 through 12, I would disable iMessage. I don't want iMessage on those. That does me no good as an IT person. All that does is create problems. But if you don't own the devices, maybe the parents don't want you to disable iMessage. If they own them, who's to say what you can do and what you can't do?
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, reading your piece, I was thinking about that because that is the problem with getting them a Mac. Then they can text at any hour of the day because, we used to take the phones out at a certain amount, certain time of the day and then realize, oh, of course, iMessage. But you're right. Like, I like the idea of being able to message her. And I don't know that I would want the school to take off my message.
But if on the flip side, if you got a kid that's like, if the iMessage app is becoming a distraction at home, you may have on the flip side parents say, hey, can you disable that? I want iMessage disabled. Mm-hmm. And it's just, again, I think it's just easier. Just like I think it's easier when the school buys the textbooks, I think it's just easier when the school buys the technology.
And so the same with schools that don't have a lot of funding. Do you agree with? I mean, it's not no different for a school like that.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's if you're going to tell parents that you have to bring an iPad, you could just have a technology fee. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're going to require them to come, the money's being spent one way or another.
But I think that's the problem that I think that's the school that my daughter goes to. I think that was the biggest problem was the some kids were coming with the brand new MacBook and some kids had nothing, and so this was their solution, and it's one solution, but I think in a lot of schools, I think when you BYOD, they're not solving that problem. So a lot of kids are coming with an iPad Pro versus nothing or a Chromebook,
Kindle Fire, $79 Kindle Fire, and again, all you really at that point, everything becomes just a web-based tool. If you're going to have a mixture, the iPad is great and the Chromebook is great, but they're different. Mm-hmm. And when you decide which one you want, you have to start like, what are your goals for technology at your school? And you work through that path and you may end up with the Chromebook or you may end up with the iPad, but you have to figure out what you want to do first and then go to the right device. Cause if you tell me like, hey, we're going to be really heavy into Google tools like Google Docs, Google Spreadsheets, Google Slides, that's great. Probably go Chromebooks. It's less expensive and it works really well with Google's G Suite. But if you say, hey, we really want to spend time with creative tools, we really want to have a great coding program, it's like, I think you should look at the iPad. But I think you just got to pick is I think the key.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have both at your school?
No, we have a couple of the Chrome desktops in our library, but they're mainly used for quick research. But the majority of the devices our students use are iPads just because we know what's on there. We can kind of plan around having a certain suite of apps.
And high school, the upper school, they also use iPads?
We stop at fifth grade, actually. We're a K-3 through fifth grade. So Chattanooga has a lot of 6 through 12s and K through fifth.
Okay, got it. And so the high school that a lot of kids go to, do they then use Macs after that? Or
It depends. So some of the schools have laptop programs. Some of them have BYOD iPad, and some of them have Chromebooks. There really is the gamut. And we get, you know, the parents come back and talk to us about all of them, and they all have complaints about them in various ways. None of the devices are perfect, and how you manage them is not perfect. But you just kind of pick a horse and ride with it. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know. Macs aren't my favorite in the classroom because they are so expensive compared to Chromebooks. And most of the educational tools that are used on the desktop end up being web-based. And so it's like, for me, it's like, just pick a really good Chromebook. Maybe not the cheapest one, but maybe a $300 one. I think the story in K-12 education is Chromebook versus iPad. And it can be a mixture of both. You can have a certain subset of your school, like, hey, maybe middle school is iPad and then high school is Chromebook. And that's fine too. But just kind of pick a horse and ride it to where every student in that class has the same device.
So another piece that you wrote was that you think that Apple should release a low-cost AirPlay-only receiver. Because right now schools, they have to have an Apple TV in order to AirPlay. And AirPlay is really helpful, especially with kids that are using iPads. Tell us about your ideas for the low-cost AirPlay-only receiver.
And so, yeah, so it's like, it's not a device that even gets on the internet. So AirPlay has this technology where it can do kind of Wi-Fi direct. It works over Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, where it's not even using the network. Like, you can put an Apple TV in a classroom, not hook it up to the internet, and give it an AirPlay name, and it can work. Like, people can AirPlay to it. And I would love to see like a $49, $69 device that is like a little HDMI stick that you just plug into a projector or plug into a TV, and it's just an AirPlay receiver. It could be added on. I mean, the Apple TV is great. I have 5 Apple TVs. I love the Apple TV. It is way overpriced for the classroom. $150 for every classroom gets really, really expensive, especially when devices like the Chromecast are $39. And I think the Apple TV is, it's kind of like, what's the term? Like, it's a solution in search of a problem. Mm-hmm. And I don't need all the apps. I need AirPlay. And so I would love to see something that's more lower cost for the classroom. Gosh, even just take the technology in like the 3rd-gen Apple TV and put it in this little stick. We don't need the latest and greatest, just something that's super reliable.
So is there a way to AirPlay to a TV without an Apple TV right now?
Not yet. But I'm saying, you know, in that, again, maybe like license the technology to projector companies as well. But yeah, but again, you can do it all. You can take the Apple TV, plug it up to a TV, but not put it on the internet, is what I was saying. Mm. So you don't even have to get the IT people involved. It's just make it a plug and play thing. And that way teachers can, you know, show everything in the classroom. But yeah, make it just a little, make it look like a Roku stick, but it's just an AirPlay receiver.
Mm-hmm. My kids, I guess I didn't realize there wasn't a way to do this without the Apple TV, because I know that in my kids' schools, they can AirPlay to the TV from their iPads. And I know that they have figured out all kinds of ways to, like, change their name on their iPad so that, you know, they'll put a picture up of something. Not something bad, just, you know, it's the same spitballs. Now it's AirPlaying a picture of a monkey to the teacher's screen. That's what they do.
Yeah, and there's ways to, like, you hook a Mac up to a TV and AirPlay to the Mac using some third-party programs. Okay. Or if a teacher has a iPad plugged up to a TV, that the teacher using Apple Classroom can actually grab a student's screen and display it as well. But there's no way to kind of natively do it that I know. There's, you know, Apple hasn't licensed that AirPlay technology.
So there, with iPads in the classroom, it seems like, oh, it's, you know, now kids are not going to have heavy backpacks. All their textbooks are going to be on their iPads. And that doesn't seem to have materialized. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, the textbook market has really just not evolved. Really, since Apple kind of announced their big book, you know, I guess it was May in 2012, 2013, they had this big book push where you could buy these textbooks from the iBook store. And it's just not ever happened. A lot of the books never just materialized. The books were $15 a piece, which sounds inexpensive. But then what you forget is when a school buys a textbook, they may use it for 4 or 5 years. So that cost is broken down over 4 or 5 years. Well, with the way that the bookstore works, unlike the app store, when I put a book on a device, it's tied to the device, or it's actually tied to the Apple ID on the device, and I can't take it back. So digital books quickly become more expensive than physical books, because, again, I've got to rebuy this, you know, $15 book every single year. And what's happened is we've gotten like digital components to our physical books. So our math book, for example, is a physical book, but then it has an app that goes along with it that we, you know, students can use as well. It just hasn't happened. Students still have textbooks. The textbook market kind of hasn't evolved. On the flip side, I'm kind of okay with that because I don't want the iPad to just be relegated to a book reader. It can do so much more with creation that I don't want it just to be an iBook viewer.
Yeah, I thought that was a really good point that you made in the piece, because I think especially, you know, when you're young and still getting used to these devices, if you just see it as a device to absorb content, to deliver content to you versus a creation device, I think that's key in teaching mm-hmm. kids technology. But what about updating textbooks? It seems like that would have made it easier to, you know, if there was a mistake or something, it would be more quickly be able to update if it was digital.
Absolutely. I mean, there's tons of advantages to digital books, but the problem is it's like just kind of like the cell phone carriers. There's not that many book publishers. There's been a lot of consolidation over the years and decades. And, it's all about protecting the profits. I mean, none of this is a technology problem. Mm-hmm. It's just a problem of money.
Yeah. And textbook companies are not the greatest.
Well, and one thing too, so an interesting fact is that Texas and California buy their books at the statewide level. So like in my district, our public schools, they buy their own books. The state of Tennessee doesn't mandate what they buy, but in Texas and California, they do. And so that really, those two books, think about how big those states are. Those two states control a lot of the money for these textbooks companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had heard that Texas controlled most of it. I didn't know that California also, but it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, and that's how also, well, it's really been good. That's why books never lean left or right, and they're right in the middle, because it's like it just you have these two states that predominantly lean left and right, and so it stays right down the middle, which is good. You want the books to be just about learning and not have any sort of spin on it.
Right. So about a month ago, you became the arbiter of what one should have on their iPhone screen,
yes.
Their home screen. You were tasked to judge people's home screen on where what they should have and where. Did you just give yourself this task on Twitter, or was it part of a larger project? I think I came in the middle of the...
Yeah, I just decided, I'm always critiquing my coworkers' home screens, and like they're all bad. I mean, they're just bad. Like I have one coworker that he has 24,000 unread emails. And at that point, like the badge is just irrelevant.
Yes.
And so it's like I kind of said on Twitter one day, my superpower is criticizing people's home screens or criticizing my coworkers' home screens. And so people just started sending me theirs, and I just started critiquing them. Mm-hmm. And it was fun. And like they're just so many of them are bad. That's what kills me. And they're just like I don't know if people look at these that much. Maybe they look at their phone less than I do, which is great. And so I have some like just general tips I think that people can listen to and then think through this. I really like to leave a empty row at the end of the home iPhone. So like as the iPhones have gotten bigger, we've gotten more like room on there. So I like to leave an empty row at the bottom. I think it just makes it look cleaner. I'll see if I can pull mine up here. Badges are not your friend. So nothing, I try to like really limit badges right now. So there's my home screen right now. Got very few apps that have badges. My email app certainly doesn't have badges. Do not allow badges on your email app. It's mm-hmm. just not a good situation. I really think folders should be kept to a minimum. And I think that you should either put them at the very top or the very bottom. And when I say very bottom, I mean like above your blank row. My current method is to have kind of three folders at the top and then the camera at the top right. And that's just kind of like a just general good opening for me. And then I don't even use those folders very much because I search for everything in Spotlight. So mm-hmm. I just pull down and search for it. Then fourth thing is delete apps you don't use. Like go through your phone. If you don't remember the last time you used like Candy Crush, just delete it. Free up the space. Just delete it. And then the last general tip, I think the best dock setup is this. Phone, email, messages, and then your music or podcast app. My dock is phone, email, messages, Apple Music. That's my dock. I think that's the best dock, and you're not going to convince me otherwise.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take a look at my screen. I've followed some of your rules. I got the empty screen. And I learned the empty row down, and I do like the empty row here. I have one folder which has all of your apps that you recommended in them because I wanted to get them easy access to them. And so I usually do that when I'm doing a show. So put everything in there so I know where to, you know, play with stuff. And I just move. Oh, wait. You said the camera should go in the right.
Top right. Yeah, top right.
Okay.
Well, and see what I... Oh, whoa. What is that? I feel like you just showed the junk drawer.
I know. I did. Well, you know, this is what you mainly commented on down here.
Oh, no. It's so bad. It's so bad.
16 rows.
So I would tell you, okay, so that iOS Today folder, mm-hmm. one reason I leave a blank spot on the bottom is if I'm beta testing an app that mm-hmm. I don't normally use that doesn't have a normal spot, that's where that goes. And that kind of is my trigger to make sure to use it.
Okay.
So I would have that iOS Today folder like on that empty row there because that comes and goes. Like if you're on vacation, you delete all those apps.
Right there.
And then that's like your trigger to look through them. That's a real dumpster fire right there. Did you ever watch Parks and Recreation?
Yes.
Did you ever watch the show? Mm-hmm. Do you remember the episode where, her name's Karen on The Office. What's her name? I'm blanking. I'm blanking on all the characters. She married Chris Traeger on the show. What's her name? She was Karen Filipelli.
Sheena Jones is her name. Yeah. What is her name in the show?
I can't even remember. I'm literally blanking on it. But she goes to her friend's house, which is played by Amy Poehler, and I'm blanking on her name, too. I've watched this show like 1,000 times. Yeah. Anyways, you guys know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So she goes to her house for the first time, and then, like, she realizes her house is, like, full of newspapers and stuff, and, like, she's basically a hoarder. That's what I feel like right now.
I
feel like you were trying to, like, maybe kind of hide that from me. Like, oh, look at my nice home screen. This is really nice.
Yeah. It's true. I was trying to hide that from you and all that. And I went through and deleted. Like, I deleted a bunch. Oh, don't look at my widgets. My widgets are out of control, too. Okay. So here I use email. And then, see, this is the work messaging app that we use HipChat, and soon we're going to use Slack. So the work messaging and then, you know, iMessage and then phone, which I guess maybe that means I do more work than I listen to music. So
I'm just like, in some ways, the dock is like the original dock for me. I think Safari was on the dock, but like this is the dock I've had since my first iPhone, and it just fits with me. I don't know. Now, I will say, you know, a feature that I would love to have on the iPhone, and my Motorola Q had it back in the day, like 2007. It was a Windows Motorola Q. It had this feature called email sync. And I could say on these email accounts, only sync them during this time. And I would love that feature for my iPhone. What I could do is I could set my personal email to, like, you know, sync, you know, every 30 minutes, like, you know, you're on the weekends. But my work email wouldn't sync, like, off hours. And what it was is, like, because right now, like, if you have it set to manual, if you open the email app, it goes and syncs everything and it vibrates or whatever if you have that turned on. But I went to, like, it literally won't even sync until Monday, maybe Monday at 6 a.m. And that's what I would do is I would have it stop syncing on Friday at 6 p.m. and it wouldn't sync again until Monday morning at 6 a.m. And maybe that wouldn't work in 2018. Maybe I guess people would expect people to be more accessible. But that I just remember back in the day, like that was a really nice feature because it kept me from like constantly being pulled into work mode after hours.
Yeah. Well, I remember. I mean, you used to be able to, like, you didn't even have your work email at home. You know, it wasn't even something that back in the day. But I wonder if with iOS 12. With the new screen time features, if you'll be able to do that, like maybe you'd be able to set that app so that you can't use it.
I still want to use my personal email though.
Well, use the same email program.
Yeah.
So if you use a different, like I have a lot of different email apps that I use, which is probably part of my disorganization as well. But if you just have, like, let's say you use, you know, Gmail, the Gmail app for your work mm-hmm. email, then you can't use it all weekend.
That would be nice. That's not a bad idea. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad idea at all.
I think we are going in the other direction of, you know, people trying to bring their lives back to, you know, and when I think when I get an email like Saturday night, from someone, I just think like you shouldn't be working then, you know.
Right.
You know, you need to have the rest of your life. So I don't know. But then I do sometimes I am working on Saturday night, even though I shouldn't be. And when I send an email to someone, I certainly don't expect them to respond. You know, it's just like, well, this is the time I'm working, and I, you know, expect you probably won't respond till Monday.
Well, and that's why I really am cautious about like after hours, what some form of messaging I use. Mm-hmm. Like if it's after hours, I'd never text somebody like about something work related unless it's an emergency. Because I know with texting, you're forcing someone to be into work mode. Mm-hmm. With email, I feel like that's your choice to read your email.
Right. That is true. I agree with that. Okay, so we have one viewer question today for you. Bob in St. Charles writes, I've been holding off on buying more HomePods. I don't know how many you have, Bob. I like to imagine your house is already covered in HomePods and you want to cover it more. He says, I'm wondering if Apple might come out with a second generation model as they've been known to do. What's the iOS Today take on the chances of a new model this year? What's your take?
I don't think so. The only thing I would think is maybe like a HomePod Nano or a HomePod Mini. Mm-hmm. But the HomePod just came out earlier this year. So I just don't think it's, you know, ripe for changing. I could maybe a price cut. I don't think so. I mean, Best Buy has been pretty regularly discounting it to $300. But yeah, I think if I was betting on anything, and I'm not even betting on this, would be a HomePod Mini.
Are you betting on anything that they're going to announce tomorrow?
I don't think so. I think nothing HomePod related. We got the software updates for AirPlay 2. HomePod's still a great device. I mean, what has it been out? Like 9, 6, 7 months? Like, yeah. It's not been out that long. It feels like it's older because it was announced a year ago.
Right. That's true. All right, well, we're going to get to our app caps. We're going to wear hats. But before we do that, I want to thank ExpressVPN. We've talked about VPNs a bunch on this show. And ExpressVPN is one that you can use with your iOS devices. All the recent news about online security breaches, it's hard not to worry about where your data goes. Making an online purchase or just accessing your email could put your private information at risk. You're being tracked online by social media sites, marketing companies, and your mobile or even your internet provider. Not only can they record your browsing history, they often sell it to other corporations, and they want to make a profit from your information. That's why I decided to take my privacy back, and I am using ExpressVPN on my iPhone and on my iPad. The app is super easy to use. It just runs in the background. Also, using it on my computer, runs in the background of the computer, phone, or your tablet. It turns on with one click. It secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address, which is key and super helpful. Also allows you to safely surf on public Wi-Fi without being snooped or having your personal data stolen. You know you want to surf on that public Wi-Fi, and even though you know you shouldn't, you do it anyway. I know I do, so it is nice to know that I am secure with ExpressVPN. It's rated number one by TechRadar and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it costs less than $7 a month. If you do not want to hand over your online history to your internet provider or your data resellers, ExpressVPN is the answer. Go to their website, do your own research, check it out, expressvpn.com/iOS today. Protect your online activity and find out how you can get 3 months free with a one-year package. Just go to expressvpn.com/iOS today. That's expressvpn.com/iOS today for 3 months free with a one-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/iOS today to learn more. And we thank ExpressVPN for their support of iOS Today. Oh, you got your hat. Let me get my hat.
Yeah, I don't wear hats often, actually. Like, I used to wear hats all the time as a kid. But I'm honestly afraid it's going to make my hair fall out. Like, I feel like if I just wear it, like, it's going to, like, compress it. And I've still got a fairly good set of hair. I'm in my mid-30s. Most of my friends are bald or going bald. So I'm really, like, kind of paranoid about that. And so it's like I feel like if I wear the hat constantly, like, it's just going to, like, I don't know. I know that doesn't make sense, but yeah.
I don't know if it makes sense. What about out in the sun? How do you protect your face from the sun? Because I'm more worried about that than your hair falling out.
I just wear, like, sunscreen. Mm. So, God, I don't look good in hats. That's tough. It's not a good look.
I think you look fine. So that's your Bobcat's hat.
Yeah, that's the Brainerd Baptist School Bobcats. Also, the paw print's good because it represents the Bulldogs here as mm-hmm. well. And they had a big win this weekend against South Carolina. So, gosh, student football season, it's funny. I love it to death. But like, I wake up when Georgia has a big game. I wake up with like this sense of just dread in some ways because I just want the game to be over. Like, my ideal Saturday is that Georgia plays at 3:30 and they can win and I can watch the night games with like peace. And I can listen to all the podcasts on Sunday and Monday. Like, cause if, like, I have a lot of college football podcasts I listen to. And if Georgia loses, I can't listen to any of them. Like, I just have to avoid it. It kills me. I care way too much about it.
Did you play football?
No, I didn't. That's why I played baseball. I don't know. It's crazy. But that's the South though. Like mm-hmm. South college football is like a religion. I mean, the Braves, honest to goodness, like the Braves are doing really well in first place and they may win their division. Like if they can be in the playoffs and if Georgia's playing Tennessee, like the bars in Georgia will have the Georgia-Tennessee game turned on. It is just – that's just how it is. I mean, I don't – it's crazy. Like, it is – the South, is you're identified by which football team you root for.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And I lived in Dallas and Houston, and it was confusing because we stuck with the Cowboys even when we lived in Houston. But that was when the Oilers were not very good. And
well, now you got the Texans.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
See, what I'll tell you about the Houston – see, like, this is how much I know. So Georgia fired their coach back in 2015, Mark Richt. Great guy. He's the coach of Miami Hurricanes now. I honestly think one of the players that got him fired was Houston's quarterback, Deshaun Watson. And I'll tell you why. He lived 40 minutes from Athens, Georgia, which is where Georgia plays. Georgia didn't recruit him until way too late. He goes to Clemson, wins a national championship. Imagine if he'd gone to Georgia. Because if Georgia wins a national championship, Mark Richt certainly still has his job. So when I see Deshaun Watson, I see a player that Georgia really missed out on, someone that grew up watching the Bulldogs and went to one of the rivals, you know, Clemson.
You should do a sports ball and Apple podcast.
Sports ball and Apple. That, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. It is funny, like, to my timeline, like, is half, like, on during the week, it's all, like, tech stuff. And then, but on Saturdays, it's like you can see your friends that are, like, football fans, too, because it goes into football season. So mm-hmm. I try to just, I know people probably follow me for tech stuff, so I don't talk about it too much. And then there's also this great Twitter account. You have to look it up. It's called Old Takes Exposed. Okay, so what this Twitter account does, like, let's say, for example, I tweeted today, I guarantee Georgia is going to win the national championship this year. Well, if the day after they don't win it, they'll retweet that tweet.
That's fantastic.
And so it's this lawyer in Florida, and like, it's his job now, and it's really funny. So the one that's on the screen right now is like is the Lions paper or the Detroit paper proclaiming that the Jets would lose to the Tiger or the Lions last night. Well, obviously the Jets destroyed the Lions and the Lions played very badly. So they'll just kind of like make fun of these people and bring up these old hot takes and remind them about them. It's hilarious. It's one of the best accounts to follow.
Does someone do that for the Apple events? Because if they don't, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, that would be a good idea, yeah. Actually. like just like, retweet these old takes. But yeah, it's a great account to follow if you're into sports because they will, and they'll roast like people on ESPN. They'll absolutely roast them.
Okay, so that gets us to your app, The Athletic, which is, you said, this is the cool app everybody's using these days by The Athletic Media Company. What do you use this app for?
So The Athletic is a new sports journalism website, but it's unique in that it's ad-free and subscription only. So obviously, like, that is, you know, kind of bucking the trend for media. I mean, there's no, like, every app, every article, with the exception of very, very few, are paywalled. It's pretty affordable. I think it's $60 a year. I had a promotion for $30 for the first year. And what they've done is, like, people that were laid off from ESPN in their last round of layoffs that were popular, they hired them. My favorite Georgia beat writer who worked for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, they hired him. So they're hiring these names that, like, you already know. And if you love your teams, like, you're familiar with these names, and they're doing well. Apparently their subscriptions are doing well, and they're growing, and they're kind of growing city by city. So, like, they have the Athletic Atlanta, and they have their crew of Atlanta people that covers the Braves, the Falcons, the Dogs, Georgia Tech. And then they kind of are growing city by city. I think they just launched the DC edition as well. So they'll be covering the Nationals and teams like that. So yeah, The Athletic is my new favorite app for this sports season.
I'm checking out this. It's not only football. I'm checking out the soccer articles. So it looks like you can try it out for a little bit.
Yeah, free trial.
Two free articles a month. And so is that with the free trial, or do you get free two free articles a month always?
I don't think it may just be the free trial. I don't think they have most of them are paywalled, I believe. I don't think it's like where you get one or two. They may, but it's really good. Like, I mean, they had articles up on Sunday from the Georgia game on Saturday that were well thought out. They're good. And then again, they're good. I mean, they've got great writers. It's the app's real clean, easy to read. I really like it. And it's, you know, it's growing apparently.
Well, I like it too. Are you a Bill Simmons fan?
I do like Bill Simmons. I do like Bill Simmons.
Is he one of your football podcasts that you listen to or not?
I really like the app, the service, the podcast that he's doing with Ryan Russillo. It's called let me look at the name of it. I really like Ryan Russillo. He's one of my favorite sports people right now. It's called Dual Threat with Ryan Russillo, and Bill Simmons comes on there. And then I also really like Breaking the Huddle with Joel Klatt. He's on Fox as well. And then, my guilty pleasure is Dog Nation Daily. It's a daily podcast about Georgia Bulldogs. So yeah, there is a daily 30-minute podcast about the Georgia Bulldogs. And so that's my favorite during the football season.
And so do you have a long commute? Like, how do you listen to, or can you listen to them while you're working or?
I have about a 20-minute commute, but I use 2X playback. And then like after my kids go to bed, my wife and I are picking up the house, I'll listen to podcasts. My lunch break, I'll eat lunch while I'm listening to podcasts. And yeah, so I love podcasts. Honestly, I think it's like the best medium in the world. I've been listening to podcasts, gosh, since 2004, since you guys started it. And, you know, I guess you guys weren't the first ones, but you guys were the first that kind of the mainstream tech that I started listening to back in, you know, 04, 05 with the original Revenge of the Screensavers. That was like one of the first podcasts I ever listened to. And I've just absolutely loved podcasts ever since then.
Oh, well, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on. And I love your pieces on 9to5Mac. And are you writing anywhere else or is just there?
Just there. I have a Saturday column that's about education, that I have kind of a general opinion column that goes up on Sundays. So like the article this past week was about how I use Alfred on my Mac. It's a really great app if you've never used it. It's kind of like Spotlight on steroids. A lot of times on Saturdays or on Sundays, I'll have an app pick. So I'll look at a category like, hey, what's the best email app for iPhone? And I'll like demo all the ones I can find and kind of make my recommendation. And those are always fun for comments just because people get opinionated when you don't pick their favorite, and that's okay too. I mean, it's a lot of this is just personal preference. So, yeah, if you go to 9to5Mac and just search for Bradley Chambers, you can follow along all my articles and have ones going up every Saturday and every Sunday.
Well, and you did also wrote a great piece on your 3-2-1 method for backing up your family photos, which was very useful to me.
Yeah, I am like paranoid about photos, and I get asked about it a lot. And so, honestly, I wanted to write this just so I could send it to people, so I could stop having to rewrite the email all the time. It's just about how to, you know, have multiple copies of your photos. How I do it, you know, multiple copies, multiple locations, and at least one of them is in the cloud. And I use Backblaze for that, and really like Backblaze.
Well, Bradley, it's been great. Bradley Chambers on Twitter, right? That's your handle.
Yes, yes, Bradley Chambers on Twitter.
Follow him. I don't know if he's still in the judging your home screen business, but you never know.
I'm making start. I should have done it with like a Patreon, like, you know, send me Venmo me or Square Cash me a dollar and I'll judge your home screen. Yeah, in a great business.
Exactly that. And then you can start your toy opening YouTube videos.
That'd be good. Yeah, that'd be good.
I think that your school is so lucky to have you. So if they ever listen to this, they're probably like, no, don't leave.
Well, I had a coworker send me his iMessage with his home screen, and I was just very disappointed in it. He was watching the stream. I was very disappointed in his home screen. Multiple badges. It was really bad. He had multiple email apps. He uses the Mail app, the Gmail app, and the Yahoo app. It's total garbage.
Like, pick see, one. No, no, I don't. I use more than one email app because then you can separate work and your home personal email.
I'm fairly certain he has the same emails in the Mail app that are in the other apps too. I think he's just getting multiple copies of them.
So. Yeah, that can be trouble. But I did see that you had one badge in yours. So
Well, that was Slack, and that's because right now I have Slack on there because I had some direct messages. And then what else do I have on there? We use an app called Paylocity for all of our time off here at work. And so I had put in a time off request that was approved on there. It's pretty cool. Like literally I can ask for time off on an app and it's approved on an app, and I use Face ID to log in, and I haven't acknowledged that I got it because this was just earlier today. So they will be cleared. Trust me. Badges are meant to be cleared, not meant to stay around.
Right. Exactly. And it was only a one badge probably.
Yes, it was a one. Not if you had double digits, just throw your phone in the river.
Bradley, thank you so much. Hopefully we will talk again, and I'm sure you'll have opinions on the Apple event, and we can definitely follow him on Twitter so you can see those there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for watching iOS Today. You can subscribe to the show, twit.tv/iOS. You can email me, Megan@twit.tv. You can watch live. We record 9 a.m. Pacific time, and that is 1600 UTC. That's 12 p.m. Eastern. And next week, I'm going to talk to Micah Sargent, and we're going to talk about pet tech. So if you have any suggestions or anything that you love, any tech, any iPhone or iPad or Apple Watch tech that you use with your pets, let me know about that. And we'll see you next week. Thanks so much for watching iOS Today. Messy hair.